You're listening to the Boss Level Podcast. Most people fear snakes. A lot of people fear public speaking. Some companies are led with fear. Why do we fear? What is fear? When is fear harmful, and when is it beneficial? Henkka Hyppönen, today's guest, is an expert on fear. He recently wrote a book about it called Why We Fear. At the end of the episode, I'll tell you how you can win a free copy of the book. But for now, I hope you enjoyed the interview. Welcome to the podcast. It's awesome to have you here.
Thank you very much, Sami, for having me.
So, can you actually tell me a little about yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm a dad of three wonderful daughters and a husband.
Yeah.
And then professionally, I'm an author of nonfiction books. I'm a keynote speaker, and especially I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a co-founder of Plus One Agency, which is a creative strategy agency. And I'm also a creative director there. That, I guess, pretty much sums it up.
Okay, so you basically have at least three professional roles and then a big private role, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And I used to have fourth also, working as a host of comedy panel show called Good and Bad News.
Yeah, on the Finnish
TV. But I stopped doing that. So now I only have three.
Yeah, that was a very popular show in Finland. And you just recently stopped working there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a couple months ago.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Now it's time to do something different.
Yeah.
But my background is in media. I started in local radio station in Kouvola in eastern Finland in 1990.
Yeah. That's a while back.
I was on the radio for 11 years in a role and then took a couple of years off and then I guess I did a 2-year stint in YLE in Finland, which is the national broadcaster, and then doing some television since 1998 and having my own production company and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's fun to be interviewing you since you have so much more experience at this than I do. But
I haven't done this in English.
Yeah. Awesome. So, a really like broad radio background and then some TV, but now you're also an author and a keynote and you run a creative strategy company. Where does your business background, where does that start?
Well, it started in 1998 when I started my first company. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the business background. And also, I think it was 1992 when I first got to a managerial position.
Okay.
And of course, all the time when I was very keen to getting better results all the time, I studied everything I could find about the media and, of course, about leadership and creativity and how to handle yourself with publicity and stuff like that. So you had to dig deep into psychology also. Not to teach that to someone else, but just to fix your head and keep it straight.
For yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And now you're running a creative strategy company. So what does that mean? What does the company do?
Well, we make our customers fit for the future. And that means that we have like ideas that what the future will be for their company. And then we start doing products and services for them. And that affects, of course, and that feeds their strategy. And that's the basic idea behind that.
Your book, Why Do We Fear, is now coming out in English?
Yeah. Yeah. Why We Fear, it'll be out December.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. So is that going to be the first book published in English?
Yes.
Yes.
It's the four previous books. They're all in Finnish.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember reading your book about being a good presenter. That was, I probably read that 10 years ago or something. Is that possible?
Yeah, it is possible. It came out in, actually it's 10 years ago.
It came
out in 2005.
Yeah.
My first book came out in 2003.
Okay. So I really like the book. I I don't really remember anything from it now, but I mean, it's 10 years ago. But I do remember that I liked it.
Yeah,
of course. I live it now, of course.
This is why this podcast is so popular.
Yes, that's when I first got the idea. I just like didn't know it back then, but yeah.
I just a couple of days ago, I took the book from my bookshelf and started reading it to see that maybe I should do a podcast. Because it's out of print, and I thought that maybe it could be a public service to put out there.
Yeah.
And then I started reading it, and although I still agree with all those ideas that are in the book, but still the one feeling that I had was shame when I was reading it.
But I mean, I guess that means progress, that like when you look at old work, you kind of feel that I've progressed, I've moved on.
Yeah, I tend to think so. And especially as a writer, I try to challenge myself all the time and have different people who are very good in that profession giving me feedback all the time.
So what, before we actually go into the topic of fear, which is the topic of your book, can you actually tell me a little about your writing process? How did you become a writer, and what's it like?
Well, I kind of had the a dream of being a writer in 1995. I think 1994, that was probably the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And my first book was basically a redo of my radio, like columns or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so that was very easy. I would just like reorganize the material, write some new material, but it was very easy because they were like stand-up comedy putting in the written form.
Yeah.
The second book, which was my first nonfiction book, that was much more harder. Because I didn't have any method. So I started writing the book, which was 200 pages long, and I had to keep it in my mind all the time. And when I changed one part of the book, I had to reorganize the whole book in my brain. And after that, I couldn't write for 6 years. Because I was so afraid to start that process again.
A traumatizing experience.
Yeah. And then I went to one of my friends and asked her that, is there some sort of writing like instructions or book that someone who has actually succeeded in writing has written, which can show some kind of methods and some kind of process to make it a little bit easier than this cognitive challenge that I took on.
Yeah.
And my friend showed me one book, and it was a 2-time Pulitzer winner, and it was a wonderful book. Although it was about writing magazine articles.
Yeah.
But I could immediately notice that, okay, this is, I can use this, and I can fix some parts of the process, and now I can use it to write a book.
Do you remember the name of the book?
It'll come to me.
Okay. And if it doesn't, I'll look it up and put it into the show notes.
Yeah, but it will come.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But it was a wonderful method. And then I used it on my third book and fourth book. And it was much, much more easier because I could concentrate on writing.
Yeah, okay. So it actually worked. It actually helped you.
Yeah, it helped me a lot.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And I mean, you've also been writing books while doing TV, while doing radio, while running your own companies. That's a lot of multitasking.
Yeah, and while having three kids.
While having three kids and a wife. So how do you find the time for that? I mean, because the way that I see it, I haven't written a book. I've written a lot of blog posts. And just writing a blog post, it's hard to do it in 30-minute chunks. You need like 2 hours to write something. So does that feel, is that how it works for you, that you need chunks of time for that, or how does
it
work?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
In writing a book, for me, some people do this differently, but for me, I have to have at least 2 weeks, preferably 1 month, to think about the theme of the book and pretty much nothing else.
Okay.
And then write the basis of the book. And after that, you can use like 2 hours or 3 hours chunks after that. Then it's easier. But I tend to take whole day for writing like,
okay.
like one essay or or a blog post or a column or usually I try to write from 500 to 1,500 words per day. And,
okay.
and then I decide before that how many words I'm going to write today, and then I'm going to end it. I actually stole this idea from Stephen King.
Okay, yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, true. Yeah, yeah.
On writing is a wonderful book about writing.
Yeah. That's really.
And
good.
He has this method of like every day he writes the same amount of words.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he quits. When he's done, like 10 a.m., then he quits and does something else. And
I guess the point is kind of to get rid of writer's block. That you just like the point is to just get something done, and then you'll edit out the parts that you don't like, and so on in later phases of the book.
Yeah,
yeah.
I guess that's one part, but also I mean one part is also teaching your brain how to formulate the work that you want to achieve during that day. Because it's not just, I understand your point about writer's block.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge and real barrier sometimes.
Yeah.
But more it's like knowing when you're writing like 90,000 words.
Yeah.
And it'll take a long time. You need that reassurance that it'll be ready. And that's kind of the basis, is that if I know that today I wrote 500 words and that was on my plan, I know that the book will be ready when promised.
Yeah, okay.
So this is kind of like gives you the freedom to do something else, because otherwise you would be during, like it took me 2 years to write that fear book.
Yeah.
So you would be constantly stressed out
about not finishing.
You
should be working on it. Yeah. Okay.
And when you're with your family, you're like, oh God, I mean,
I'm not writing.
But when you know that, this week's work is done.
So it's basically like pacing yourself
with the
writing. Yeah. Okay, well, that's interesting.
And then editing after that and stuff like that you can do in 1 hour chunks. That's much easier.
Yeah. Okay.
But thinking and providing something original and interesting, I mean, that takes a lot of time, at least for me.
And a lot of, I mean, after reading your book about fear, I was thinking that there's a lot of like studying involved, like just like reading a lot and thinking about it and going into it and talking to people about it. And that's probably a large chunk of the work.
Yeah. I haven't counted, but my estimate is that there are 750 scientific articles or research papers that was the basis for the book. And I guess there's somewhere around 200 like studies that got into the book in some form.
And
of course all the books and all the interviews and all the conversation. And sometimes some of these things are so hard that you really have to take a couple of days to understand them.
Yeah.
For example, when going through with Dr. Stephen Porges about the physiology of human being, I mean, on the nerve level, it is not simple.
So normally people study for 5 years to kind of understand that, but you have a couple of days.
Yeah. I got like 2 hours, so hit me.
That's really interesting. Yeah, but I think the book turned out really, really well. I really liked it a lot, and so I guess we could kind of start moving into the topic of fear.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So, let's get started with just simply why fear. Why did you pick fear as a topic for the book?
So I was so frustrated, since people understand fear in, I guess, mostly completely. Wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to think that it's some sort of like magical power that comes when you're trying to perform on your highest levels and kind of messes up everything.
Okay, so it's a negative thing.
It's a very negative thing. And then people tend to think that there are no tools that you can actually use to dismantle fear. And I thought that was a big problem, both in individual and in corporate life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because teams, they don't work well together if there is fear involved.
Yeah.
If you start editing yourself in a creative meeting, I mean, it doesn't lead to any original ideas. Yeah. Or if you're afraid to see new customers or exploring new areas,
yeah.
I mean, that affects you greatly. Or if you're afraid of public speaking, most of the things that we have to do nowadays, it doesn't matter what your profession is public speaking. Yeah. And then the system starts working and people think that, okay, this is how nature works, or this is some sort of magical thing that happens there. Or at its worst level, people tend to think that maybe I'm shy, maybe I'm scared easy. And then they start to control their environment and they spend more time in the situations that don't actually help them, or they can't get closer to their own goals.
Yeah.
And they're in a safe area. And of course we need that safe area, but in order to get to those places where we can really provide some value and challenge ourselves and grow, also, then we have to face fear. And so this is the basic idea. And then the whole word is problematic, because everybody can say anything about fear, and it's correct, because it's not a fixed thing.
Yeah. It's not a scientific term. Yeah.
And I'm always amused about grown-up men who say that I'm not afraid of anything, because that usually means two things. The first thing is that you have a very severe brain damage in your limbic system. Namely, your amygdalas, because it's a pair, your amygdalas are not working. And the other thing is that you might be a sociopath or a psychopath. And that's not nice to other people around you. So this is basically what they're saying. And of course, they mean that they don't consciously all the time think about things that they are scared of. But the system is working all the time. It doesn't matter where we are. The system is working all the time. And Dr. Stephen Porges calls this neuroception, that we are scanning our surroundings all the time. Is that is it safe, dangerous, or life-threatening?
Yeah.
And if it's safe, then we are usually on our highest cognitive level. And we are also on our highest emotional and social level there. So this is what creative people usually notice in group settings, that something magical happens in a group setting, and then we start getting ideas that were actually no one's ideas, that they kind of like formed. It was like emerging from somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think this is pretty much, this has something to do with fear, that even though it's always scary to say something that someone might challenge in a group settings, but when people start doing that, they are constantly like in a dangerous situation, but they still feel safe, and so they're in their highest cognitive level and also in their highest social mode. And if we feel that the surroundings are or something in the surroundings is dangerous or life-threatening, then we regress to defensive mode.
Yeah.
And fight or flight is, of course, the first that we inherited from mammals. And then there's this next level, not the boss level, but the next level, regressing to reptile mode, which is basically oxygen-saving mode. And you don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Well, actually, sometimes you want to, because if someone attacks you and there's no possibility to fight back or flee, then the best strategy in evolution has been to be completely limp in that situation, because you don't feel anything and you don't provoke the attacker.
Yeah, and I think one of the big things with this is that that we tend to think about these like dangerous or life-threatening situations just as like snakes or like really threats like this. But I guess your point is that this can also happen in a social setting, that you can kind of feel that like you saw a snake, even though there's definitely not a snake in the room.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Yeah.
The system isn't like on and off.
Yeah.
Of course, it can change rapidly, but it's not on and off.
Yeah.
For example, if we are in a situation like this, and I would be scared, and you actually couldn't probably see it on my face, but you could somehow hear it from my voice, because you cannot fake voice. That's too hard. And one of the reasons is that that vagal nerve is attached to our vocal cords and the voice box in our throat.
Okay.
So and vagal nerve, of course, is the primary nerve to put us into flight or fight mode, or take us into the social mode, or into the reptile mode. But we can go back to that later on. But you could actually hear it, and it will affect you.
Yeah.
And your amygdalas would light up, probably dimly, and the vagal nerve, the signal for your heart would retract, and start preparing you to conquer some sort of attacker or whatever it is in this situation. And you could even smell it, not consciously, but there's a chemo signal in fear that is different from sweat or when you're sweating in sports.
So
basically you don't even understand that this is fear, but the systems are working and they affect how we actually behave.
So there's a lot of situations where we should try to create a safe environment and get rid of fear. Are there any situations where we could actually use fear to our advantage? I mean, of course, there's the obvious of like getting out of danger. Of course, that's why we're still here and we're like we exist as a species. But in a business setting, can fear be useful sometimes?
Yeah, I think so, because fear is energy.
Yeah,
and it helps you to prepare to something. So that is probably where fear is at its best. But the problem is that after creating the term burning platform, everybody has thought that burning platform means that you put your employees on a burning platform and then sprinkle some petrol and some oxygen there. But it doesn't work like that. And the whole metaphor is wrong. Even according to a guy who came up with that metaphor, it was supposed to mean that the leader or the manager is taking the responsibility to do the changes and not put other people on the burning platform. That was not the idea. But people understand that the fear is the most primal emotion, and they understand that we have to react to that.
Yeah.
So managers tend to overuse this. Mm-hmm. And when there is a change coming, or they want to like have more power or more influence on people, this is the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
Just make everyone scared, and then you can control them, and then they are doing something. But we can challenge the thinking, then are they working smartly?
Yeah.
So good managers and leaders, I think they have the ability to understand that now it's not a time to push more pressure into our people. Just that now the risk taking is getting lower, and of course the explorative behavior kind of vanishes in the organization.
Yeah.
And we have seen this many times after 2007.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like full panic and. Especially managers who have using fear as an energy, like an energy, putting people into moving mode, and they have really struggled because they are pushing more pressure on people, and their cognitive abilities are declining all the time, and they're thinking, what's it about? And they're pushing more pressure, and people get more stupidier.
Do you ever feel frustrated with the fact that, I mean, I remember, like, if you read Deming's Out of the Crisis, which is written, I think it's in the 70s or at least in the 80s, and one of his biggest themes in the book is fear and how we need to drive fear out of organizations. So this is not exactly a new topic in that sense.
No.
It's crazy that, like, still in 2015, this is still really a huge issue.
But I think the one of the problems is that I wanted to tackle in this book that no one has really dismantled it.
Yeah.
because we have like sentences that there's nothing to fear but fear itself. I mean, that's very helpful if you're having panic attacks. Or in the company settings, we haven't really seen big companies that has done this. Because the basic Tayloristic model of leading people, it works pretty well with fear. And also, if there's a power struggle in the company and it's not transparent, then fear is primary tool to get acceptance and raises and get into the higher level on the organization. But now things have changed. And one of the biggest changes is that we are moving into the era of customer experience and employee experience, which are the sides of the same coin. So you won't get those best people to work in your organization. Of course, you get in some companies, if the brand is good enough, people tend to pay all that is coming towards them. But most of the time, you won't get the best employees if the employee experience is bad. And the fear is the first thing that you have to get rid of there. And let me be very specific that I don't mean that like fearless organization is the one that is like some side of yoga retreat. I don't like that at all. Okay, I like yoga retreats. They are very good, but not in a company and business surroundings. But what I mean, for example, that we can have an honest conversation about something that you did and probably didn't even mean to do. So if you, for example, offended me, but you're not aware of it. It's a high risk for me to bring it up in a conversation. You can always say that, don't be childish, or I didn't mean anything by that. But it affects my ability to work in a group with you. So this is like the kind of thing that I think where we can dismantle fear. First unmasking it and then put it into pieces. And then maybe we can have a conversation that you said, I didn't understand that I'm repeating this joke all the time. I didn't mean anything by it. And then it's on the open air, and then probably we can trust each other more, and then we can, on a creative level, move towards riskier territories.
Listening to this just reminds me of Patrick Lencioni wrote a book about organizational health and how organizational health is going to be like the big next move in organizations, and I think we're like already seeing parts of it. That there's definitely, I totally agree that there's the employee satisfaction, the customer experience. They're kind of coming up more and more. But like, then again,
like companies like AirAsia, Zappos, Airbnb, Reactor, Plus One Agency,
and definitely. But then again, I mean, I'm just reading the biography of Elon Musk. I read the like Steve Jobs biography, and it would be easy to argue that like their main tool for leadership is fear.
Yeah, and that's true, and I don't challenge that.
Yeah,
I don't challenge that you can't get good results by leading with fear.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that it's not the only option.
Yeah.
And this is the idea that there are two ways of actually getting to next level and actually getting outstanding results.
Yeah.
And this is the main point, because I think although Steve Jobs has probably done like many good things, and I'm a big fan of Apple, of course. I don't know what did I say, of course, but I am. I mean, they understood something long time ago that some of the competitors haven't understood yet. But anyway, the idea there is that everybody is reading the autobiography of Steve Jobs, and they think that the fear-based model that he had in his leadership might be the key to being an extraordinary leader.
Yeah.
But I think it's the other way around.
Yeah.
I think that he was an extraordinary leader, an extraordinary producer. Very creative in producing stuff. And he succeeded in spite of his leadership style. And in some cases, it probably helped.
So if we think about people who think that like there are situations where I fear too much that it would be actually beneficial for me to not be that afraid of public speaking, for example. Do you have any methods for getting rid of that?
Yeah, of course, enduring that until it's gone. That's
yeah, that's a good tip.
That's the best way. Yeah. And also, you can think that actually being a little bit anxious in that situation helps you perform.
Yeah, it's good.
It's energy.
Yeah.
And you can also use your mental capacity to use that as an energy.
Because
if you interpret it, your heightened like reaction to that situation as an excitement. Mm-hmm. That helps.
Yeah.
And I know this sounds dumb, but there's a lot of research that shows that if people, even though they might think that they are afraid, but they try to say to themselves that I am excited, it'll actually turn into better performance, even in mathematics tests singing or public speaking. And then, of course, what you can do is to use your vagal tone and vagal break in a manner that calms you down. Mm-hmm. Because, like I mentioned before, there's a signal that goes in your vagal there's a signal in your vagal nerve that goes into your heart, and that keeps your pulse as it is at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But if the situation turns into threatening, then the pulse retracts and lets your pulse be loose, because you need that extra energy to cope with the situation. But what you can do is to prolong your exhalation to actually strengthen that tone to your heart.
Okay.
And you can do it by breathing longer, but you can also do it while you're speaking.
Yeah.
And how you do that is that you just add words into your sentences.
Yeah.
And don't breathe.
In between,
And so, that's the way to do it.
So it's basically, the idea is that you can do physical things that will have a mental effect.
Yeah. Because this was the thing to dismantle this whole thing, that we are physical beings. And there's a physiology behind everything that's happening, even in our consciousness.
Yeah.
It doesn't... At least what I think, it doesn't work
without
consciousness. But also, I was thinking that there is a basis for these reactions. And they come so long. Those reaction models were born long before we were humans. Because they are a defense mechanism. So they have evolved with human beings.
Yeah.
So there's a strong physiology behind those reactions.
Yeah, for sure.
And those are pretty simple methods there.
Yeah. I also remember reading like from David Rock about this situation. Like if there's a situation that you feel that you're kind of already too accustomed to, that is kind of like there's a presentation that you've done 20 times and you feel that like when I go there, I'm probably not going to be excited enough, that I'm going to do it routinely. And I'm not going to be at my best because I'm not excited.
Yeah.
And then David Rock has this tip about thinking of like, it's kind of the opposite, that it's kind of like you thinking about failing it and you messing it up, and that will raise your heightened level of awareness for that situation. And you can actually use that as an advantage for you.
I use that all the time.
Yeah.
I've been doing so much television and so much radio that I usually don't get excited or frightened
about this.
Before audience.
So
a good example of this was a couple of years ago when I had the opportunity to interview Arnold Schwarzenegger in Nordic Business Forum, and there were somewhere around 5,300 people in the audience.
Yeah.
And he would have his own speech before that, then we would have 40 minutes on the stage together.
Yeah.
And I was in the curtains watching him speaking, laughing, having a good time.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of enjoying his speech, and we didn't have any time to have a conversation before that, I realized that I'm so relaxed that I'm going to be doomed on the stage. Because the energy level is so high and I'm so like relaxed and laughing and listening to him.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, I use this method a lot, and I started thinking that everything that might go wrong. I can't speak English.
Yeah,
I don't remember anything. The audience is booing to me. And then I felt the surge of energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I of course relaxed and thought about that this is going to be good, this is going to be funny, and even gave myself a suggestion, because I didn't know how to end that. Kind of gave myself a suggestion that it'll come up in a conversation that I will know a perfect end for this conversation.
Okay, perfect. So it's kind of like drug users have these like uppers and downers, and you kind of have to balance it out the perfect level.
Not so familiar with that, but I can take your word for it.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Closing off, what are you currently interested in and looking into?
I can't really say, because the idea for my next book is so simple.
Someone's going to beat you to it.
Someone's going to beat me to it. So, yeah. But I'm always studying the different thing, and of course, future is one of the things that I'm really digging into, because I'm most interested about where people are now and where they should be now. Not that interested in about what's going to happen in 10 years. Of course, you have to have that on site.
Yeah.
But I think that we're living in times when so many people are just so off the map at the moment, that how they could use technology and how they should think, and what kind of schools and business schools they are going. This is, I think, central to my thinking at the moment, to kind of like move that group of people to a little more advanced position.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Perfect. So, how about a book that you're reading or that you've recently read that was something that you'll remember?
Well, at the moment, I'm reading a Robert Rodriguez book. It's an old book, and it's basically a diary. It's called "A Rebel Without a Crew."
Okay.
There's a guy who has invented Hollywood movie. This, he basically did them by himself. And that's the kind of creativity that I'm really into. That you simplify something that has been so hard to do and so costly, and someone comes up with a creative solution and kind of reinvents a new genre. But I want to get inside his thinking, and so far it has been very helpful.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Well, thanks a lot for your time. It was a really, really fun chat.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
Since the interview, Henkka's book has been released, and as a Christmas gift to you, dear listeners, I'm giving out 2 free copies. Share this episode on Facebook or on Twitter for a chance to win. I'll select 2 of the best recommendations on Christmas morning. If you win, I'll send you a promo code that you can use in iBooks to get a digital version of the book for free. Boss Level is going to take a slightly longer break due to the holidays. The next episode will be out on the 11th of January. Happy holidays, everyone.